Hi, Noel, this is Caitlin Benson-Allett.
Okay, how you doing?
Good, how are you doing this morning?
Oh, fine. I had a little jet lag. I just got back from France.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it's good that we're talking early in the morning instead of late in the afternoon then. I hope you had a good trip.
Very good, very good. Nice and Monaco.
Oh, excellent. How nice. Well, as I mentioned in the kind of provisional questions that I sent to you, Eugenie Brinkema and I are doing a special issue of the Journal of Visual Culture called The Design and Componentry of Horror. And in keeping with the project of the journal, our aim is to think about the horror genre transmedially and to think about aesthetics of horror that move between genres. And that was why we wanted to close the issue by interviewing you and think about the effect of the philosophy of horror on the field. Because one of the things that's really struck me is that, and maybe I'm biased because I'm a film scholar, but one of the things that's really struck me is the degree to which the philosophy of horror lit up horror studies in film studies. Perhaps more so than in literary studies or cultural studies. So I guess maybe I'll start with that question. Where do you feel like the book has had the greatest impact or been the most warmly received?
Well, it has definitely had an influence not only in film studies, but filmmaking. Steven Schneider, who is now a producer and was a producer on the Paranormal series, said in Variety that his influences were Stephen King, Martin Scorsese, and Noel Carroll's philosophy of horror. So there's an impact on filmmaking. I think it's also had, as you say, an influence in film studies. Although one area you didn't mention where I think it's had a big influence is in philosophy and aesthetics. It was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, book-length studies to engage with the general issue of the relationship of art and emotions. I mean, I realize, of course, that Aristotle beat me to the punch. It is a kind of a reinstitution of an attempt to make respectable once again the kind of Aristotelian analysis of tragedy, whereas he thought of the tragedy as eliciting a compound emotion of pity and fear. I analyzed the horror in a comparable way in terms of a compound emotion of fear and disgust. And I think, in a way, I wasn't the only person who was interested in philosophy and in aesthetics, returning to the issue of emotional engagement, which formalism in many ways bracketed, but also the study of negative emotions. Emotions that, on the face of it, look like paradoxical that one would want to undergo them. So philosophy is another area. I'm not surprised that it didn't have much uptake in cultural studies, since its concern is much more in terms of sociological concerns. In terms of literary studies, its impact couldn't be as large as it was in philosophy or film studies or media studies in general, for the simple fact that literary studies is so large and so impossible, well, not impossible, but it's very hard to have a really big impact in literary studies. I guess, though, I would say that in certain areas of psychology, especially social psychology, there's been a kind of fruitful interaction between my studies and things like horror and suspense and certain works of social psychologists.
Mm-hmm. When you say making Aristotelian philosophy respectable, again, I mean, one of the things that resonates for me, but it also seems to reflect the project of making horror respectable again in the 1990s. I mean, there really wasn't much of a field of horror studies when you started out. And so I was wondering, when you were undertaking the philosophy of horror, whether a kind of bid for respectability for the genre itself or for the study of negative emotions was also part of your project.
Well, certainly let me say one thing about both the intellectual and then the financial origin of the book. The intellectual origin of the book came, as some people might recall, I was very opposed to the dominance of Lacanian, Althusserian models in film studies, which I thought was becoming monotonous as every work of cinema was discovered to do the same thing, which was to position subjects for the purposes of ideology. I especially railed against the notion that certain aspects of cinema, like perceptual representation and the assimilation of figures, like point of view editing, could be best analyzed in terms of psychoanalysis, and I tried to field alternative cognitive models for them. After I did that, one person, actually my old dissertation advisor in cinema, Annette Michelson, said to me, "Well, even if you're right about that, don't you have to admit that psychoanalysis is a much more powerful tool for and emphasizing and explaining emotional responses, especially emotional responses to things like horror, where psychoanalysis had more or less been assumed to be the lingua franca of the media." So I felt that a continuation of trying to offer alternatives to the ruling views of psychoanalysis made it imperative for me to look toward how the resources of a more cognitively oriented psychology and a more cognitively oriented philosophical position might give resources that would enable us to actually, with much more fruitfulness, determine the important variables in the elicitation of horror. I often thought that Freudian analysis especially is not very strong on giving specific analyses of specific emotional states. It more or less assumes certain views of the emotions without spelling it out. So I began to study the philosophy and psychology of the emotions to see what we could come up with to deal with what I thought of as the lack of specificity in the ruling approaches to the emotions. And I took horror as my example. I would also like to suggest that in this, I wasn't just opposing various post-structuralist tendencies, but a general tendency in aesthetics, including the new criticism, to think that it was really irrelevant to aesthetics what emotional responses were. One of the big positions or one of the big fallacies in the new criticism was the affective fallacy, which more or less said that for purposes of aesthetical and literary analysis, really arousal of emotion was not really relevant, whereas of course Aristotle would have made the arousal of emotion central to his aesthetics. Let me just say
Uh-huh.
The book was an editor named Germana at Rutledge. I asked him, because at that period Rutledge had a series on British authors, very small British authors, I asked him if Rutledge might be interested in my writing one of these short monographs on the author of the Midwich Cuckoo, and he said no, the British Rutledge handles that, and they only want British people to write about British novelists like John Wyndham, and he said, but because he had noticed that I had given a lecture at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, he noticed that I had given a lecture on horror. He said, I would accept, however, a book from you on horror. And of course, at that point, I was a philosopher, no longer a cinema studies person, and I knew that none of the big philosophy presses like Oxford or Harvard or Cornell would ever accept a book with the philosophy of horror, with a title of philosophy of horror. I knew that, the reviewers would send back the review that would say, there is no such thing. but since I was offered a commission and a guarantee, I jumped into it.
Uh-huh.
One other thing is, I'm not sure how much of a pioneer I actually was. I was born in 1947, which I think is the same year that Stephen King and Steven Spielberg were born. And of course, we were a generation that really we were brought up on movies, especially horror movies, things like Chiller Theater. Television programs like the Twilight Zone. We were the purchasers of magazines like Famous Monsters and of Filmland.
Yeah.
And when we came of age, we wanted to actually emphasize our beloved childhood experiences. In fact, in the beginning of the philosophy of horror, I say in the introduction that it was my opportunity to prove to my parents that I wasn't wasting all my time and money on magazines.
Yes, that's how I felt about my first book, too, which was about horror in the video era, or reading home video through horror films. I dedicated it to my mother in order to remind her that all of those quote-unquote wasted hours had, in fact, gotten me tenure.
I'm sure Stephen King and Steven Spielberg are sitting on piles of money to say to their parents, I told you so.
It's at the root of horror, evidently. So one question I had from you before I kind of wanted to ask you about your opinions on changes in horror sense and horror transmedially since 1990 is why you decided to approach the project as a genre study rather than a study of an emotion. And I guess what I mean by that is thinking through art horror by starting with movies that we take to be part of the horror genre, whether or not they actually successfully elicit art horror, rather than looking at films that successfully elicit art horror, whether or not they have been considered a part of the horror genre.
Well, I guess there are a couple of issues there. One, of course, is that I approached it as a genre because that was my original intention. I also think, that there are certain genres that take emotional states as their very name. I mean, to a certain extent, melodrama, insofar as we call it, things like tearjerkers and mystery and suspense, and even to a certain degree, comedy as comic amusement. These these are genres that contrast with things like film noir, which are really, I think, less a matter of categorization in terms of certain generative principles, and more, and in that sense, less genres that we understand from the production side, and film noir, which is something that's more like a critic's construction that's employed metaphorically. So, you know, we're constantly learning that, you know, such and such is noirish, even if it has, you know, no dark lighting, but has certain kinds of themes like, you know, doomed lovers on the road or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I took horror as being one of these kind of genres, again, like the way Aristotle thought of tragedy, as having a certain kind of structure as a result of its aim of eliciting a certain emotional response. Now, you're right that by doing that, take the high and the low, but I think in analyzing genres and artistic categories in general, you have to understand that what you're analyzing is the intention to do something, where the intention can fail. If you don't think of it that way, if you don't think of horror as intended to elicit a certain emotion, but say it's the thing that you only count as horror things that successfully elicited, well, then you no longer have a descriptive account, you have an evaluative account. You're only talking then about the best of horror or the best of tragedy. Also, I never would have started with the idea of the word horror and then tried to isolate it in terms of all the artworks that had that, because the word horror is, of course, very complex and covers a vast amount of territory. So existential angst might be counted as horror. That's one thing. And then, of course, a movie like Them about giant ants might also cover that. Also, people talk about horror or terror in certain terms of certain atrocities like the Holocaust. So, I think it would have been an unmanageable project to try to offer a theory of all of the various kinds of films or fictions that touched on one or another aspect of horror. I mean, think how impossible it would be to have a theory that covered Bergman's Winter Lights dealing with existential angst, Them about gigantic ants, and then Schindler's List. It would be too unwieldy. So I never even thought of doing that. I always thought of dealing with the narrow trans genre phenomena of what I called art horror. In fact, I called it art horror just to make sure that people didn't think I was talking about things like the Holocaust or the horrors of the 20th century or Les Lecs, Kolakowski's notion of metaphysical horror.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons, in fact, that I wanted to call it art horror, although that allowed a lot of the critics to make tease me a bit, saying, you know, really what art horror is what, you know, the average American feels going into a gallery in Chelsea.
They have to get their licks in, huh? I think it's an incredibly helpful distinction, in part because it allows us to, it allows for one thing for us to think differently about the kind of threat that one encounters in you know, films like Cannibal Holocaust or other snuff films, or, you know, films in which the violence is purported to be real, right? I think that as you say, it's what allows us to get at the paradox of fiction, and thus, by extension, you know, kind of what is at stake in movies like Faces of Death or Cannibal Holocaust that are claiming to be real and that people purport to have some kind of belief in.
Or let's think more of the snuff films that ISIS makes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, precisely.
As people were saying, there really are no such things as snuff films, but ISIS is putting them on the internet on an unfortunately regular basis, and certainly we want theoretical resources to make the distinction between the Exorcist and what ISIS is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, since you brought up the internet, that I mean, ISIS is certainly a different category, as we're suggesting, but I did wanted to ask you about digital horror, and I mean, precisely because Philosophy of Horror came out in 1990, it's marking a point before this turn towards either, you know, computer-generated special effects, which I'm less interested in, or other digital genres of horror, such as horror, survival, video games that are building on many of the plots and tropes, the horror objects that you describe in Philosophy of Horror, or web installations like the one I sent you, Take This Lollipop. And so this might be a kind of basic question to start out with, but do you see any reason that digital media or the interactivity of digital media couldn't evoke art horror?
Well, I mean, as a philosopher, the first thing I want to say is, in principle, I don't see any reason why not. As you point out, a number of the plots, summaries are similar, and of course, where there is visual imagery, the visual imagery comes very often resembles things that we are familiar with visually from the horror genre, from Space Invaders on, which I realize is digital. On the other hand, there are certain kinds of things that may be complicating factors. Not that they might not be transcended, but if you think about them, they might be somewhat complicating. The first is, of course, that when we're involved in an activity, that often we put ourselves on, so to speak, some kind of suspended gear. I mean, and a few times in my life where I found myself in truly fearsome situations, like driving a car and skidding on ice and having to really take over the situation and remind myself that I'm supposed to turn the wheel in the direction of the skid. I really didn't feel any emotions. I went, so to speak, into a freeze mode and just concentrated on what I had to do. Now, when you're playing a video game, of course, you don't really feel your life is in danger. But I think that, like perhaps a soldier in battle, or like the experience I had with the skid, you have to concentrate.
Yeah.
And that kind of concentration might mean that you want to bracket out any emotional engagement. Also, horror tends to, especially art horror, tends more to lead to a kind of freeze response. I mean, very often in a dangerous situation, we'll freeze before we take any action.
Right.
That's not a great kind of reaction to play a video game, especially a kind of shooter game.
Yeah, that's maybe, what makes me so bad at it.
Maybe the manufacturers of the video games, even if they could scare the bejesus out of you, might not want to do it because then you'll stop playing.
Yeah. That's a good point.
So I think that there are these possible complicating factors, which, as I said, I don't think could be over. It can't be overcome by someone much more knowledgeable at the construction of video games than I am. I mean, maybe in fact they would be really terrific. But look, I'm just to be very graphic, you know, you don't want to make a video game that's going to make the player throw up all over it.
Right, yeah, no, that's true. I mean, that was one of the things that I was kind of thinking about in terms of revulsion. I mean, these monsters that you see in games like Fear or Silent Hill, they're terrible, and they're repulsive, but their repulsion also has to be kind of different in kind, because because you need to touch them, right? You need to beat the bejesus out of them, and so that's got to be that's got to somehow change the kind of repulsion that we're experiencing if our goal is to interact with them.
Maybe what you have to do is you have to figure out how you can elicit the kind of repulsion that one feels when you suddenly see an ugly spider on your arm and you kind of flinch and want to expel it and destroy it.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Huh. Yeah. So it's going to be a complication of a kind of art repulsion and real repulsion then, where you feel some, and maybe the repulsion is changing that kind of freeze response when we feel like we have the possibility of interactivity, of engaging and conquering instead of simply observing the repulsive object.
But it's going to be much more complicated. It's just going to be much more complicated once you take the challenge of interactivity on board. I think than what you find in a horror novel or a horror fiction. I always thought the way to get a little more of a jolt in a horror fiction was, you know, someone like Stephen King can get his publishers to do all kinds of indulgences in terms of typography and graphics in his novels. I always thought that if someone like that kind of influence could make a horror novel that had like a little jack-in-the-box mechanism so that something pops out, like a hand or something. That might bring the novel a little close to the kind of surprise you can inject in cinema.
Right, or some kind of like squid that would explode and ooze something disgusting that you don't want on your hands.
Well, that's a really, I hadn't thought of that. That's a really good idea. So that on one page, when you put your hand on the page, the ink dissolves and turns into red.
Right. And that you have some kind of like sticky, tacky, visceral encounter with the desire not to touch. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you and I have to really patent this before this article gets published.
I won't publish this part of the interview. We'll keep that between us. I don't know if you had a chance to see that kind of Facebook Connect app, Take This Lollipop.
I really only got back, you know, I've only got back very late last night.
Oh, okay.
I only got to look at your questions just a few minutes ago.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then I won't take up too much of your time with that. It seemed interesting to me that now these kind of web horror apps can tie into your social media. And so instead of having to kind of assimilate a character's response, you become a character. You are yourself the object under threat. In this case, a psychopath seems to be going through your Facebook profile and then having some kind of mental breakdown as he drives towards your address on Google Maps. But one could make the point perhaps as well about video games and, you know, that identification versus assimilation will change for art horror in new media. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that or experiences in moments where new media had changed your identification, your assimilation to identification.
Yeah. No, I'd have to think a bit more about that. I'm sorry. I didn't,
no, that's...
I didn't look at that.
Yeah.
But it's a very interesting question. I mean, I will have to take a look at it and try and extend my thinking about it.
So another question I wanted to ask you is about changes in horror film and the kind of mode towards serialization and franchisation over the last 25 years. I mean, I think you make a fair point that killers like Mike Myers or Jason Voorhees aren't monsters, that they're sadists, not kind of categorically incomplete monsters. But then I thought, well, you know, once Jason survived, I think he's up to 13 sequels now, plus he had a television show, and Mike Myers is somewhere close as well, that do they start to become superhuman and monstrous?
Maybe you're referring to something that I've forgotten I wrote, but I think all those figures are monsters. I think they are because, well, obviously, after the first Friday the 13th, Jason, I mean, the first Friday the 13th, it's his mother, right?
Right, right.
But then from then on, he's a supernatural being. Michael Myers, I believe, well, even in the first one, I mean, when the body disappears at the end, we do think we know that he's just not a psychopath. I think of most of those psychopaths, and also the ones with less enormous strength, like Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
I think of those people as monsters. They're not really. They're not the kind of psychopaths that you find in diagnostics like the Minnesota Multiphase First Personality Test. I mean, really, Hannibal Lecter is just a satanic figure. He knows what's going on in the minds of people, you know, while he's locked up in his cell, and has terrific hypnotic powers. Mm-hmm. He's also very brilliant. I mean, he's a Mephistophelian figure. He's basically a kind of satanic force. As many of these psychopaths tend to be. And then there are the ones that have this really superhuman strength, including Henry Serial Killer. I mean, he's this incredibly indomitable, unstoppable force. If Henry's got his ire up about you, you're dead.
What do you mean?
They invest these figures are invested with powers beyond the human and beyond anything that's a scientifically credible notion of schizophrenia. Now, one thing, of course, I was always criticized for was the fact that I denied that Psycho was a horror film, and I have to confess that in one sense I think the criticism is right, and in my fault. Really, you remember, that book was written in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really thought about, what I really thought about Norman Bates was that he caused the feeling of horror he did because basically he was at least a transvestite with a strong insinuation that he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 80s, the last thing I wanted to say or be thought to be saying was that I thought that gay people were unnatural.
Right.
Or that gay people were violations of nature. And I thought, basically, I think that he did strike audiences in 1960 when Psycho came out as being unclean, as being unnatural because of prejudices against gay people.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to put that in the book because I could just imagine someone saying, "No, Carol says that gay people are unnatural. Gay people are impure. Gay people are violations of nature."
Right.
But I do think that that's why he was so effective, and that's why people categorize it as horror, because at that point in time, the idea of gay people as impure and violations of nature was really, you know, probably the cultural dominant.
Yeah. Wow, what a...
So I have to confess that I was probably wrong to move in the way I did, but I was really trying to be politically correct.
Yeah, no, I can really see the quandary that you would feel.
Well, especially since I was being hammered for being politically incorrect in so many other ways.
Right.
I didn't want to be hammered. I especially didn't want to be hammered in that way.
Right. I can see the villagers with their pitchforks out, you know, going through the text with a fine tooth comb, looking for evidence that anyone who's not towing the capital T theory line is has some kind of prejudice that they can attack.
Or I could even imagine somebody of a very different disposition, maybe an evangelical person saying, "Ah, look, he agrees with us. These people are abominations."
Yeah, right. Huh. So what do you make then? I mean, if we think about like these figures like Lecter or Myers as being like kind of, you know, psychopaths but more, then I think about films like Hostel or Saw, in which I mean, I know there's a psychopath guiding the operations in Saw, but the actual kind of terrible, monstrous acts of violence are done by normal, everyday people.
They are, but I mean, but I think, especially in Saw, the look. I mean, there are a number of films that depend on coincidences and things going according to plan that are so outlandish that, you know on the second viewing, if you're watching it a second time, you're watching for something else. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in Vertigo, if you think of how incredible Vertigo is in terms of the various things it asks us to presuppose, that the schemer knew that Scotty wouldn't get to the height of the tower. That,
yeah.
Scotty, who is such a great detective, wouldn't figure out that the wife wasn't even in San Francisco. Let alone in the second part, that supposedly the Scotties had intimate relationships with the Kim Novak character, Madeline, and he doesn't know that it's the second. This is the same woman second time around.
Right.
And I think that Vertigo is a great film, and I watch it again and again, but I don't watch it for suspense anymore.
Right.
It's that it's an incredibly interesting example of romantic love. So So what am I saying? That, well, the same kind of plotting that the criminal mastermind does in Vertigo is exponentially raised by the criminal mastermind in Saw. I mean, he predicts exactly how people are going to respond. He plans these massive Rube Goldberg machines. So I do think he's kind of like a Hannibal Lecter. I mean, he's like an Olympian god moving human beings like chess pieces. Hostel is a little bit different, and I would be less inclined to call Hostel a horror film. You know, we also have a category in between, which you know, we can use or appropriate the French notion of the Grand Guignol.
Right.
I think that Hostel is really a Grand Guignol, which is, you know, a kind of I don't know what to say, a kind of exploration of elaborate torture and elaborate devices of torture and execution.
That makes sense, yeah. And I think that you know, it's bizarre to me in a way that people think of the new French extremity movies like Frontier or A l'Intérieur as horror instead of Grand Guignol, that they'd go to this kind of Anglo tradition instead of looking at the French theatrical tradition to understand this kind of excuses to open up the body, really.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I mean, not every example of opening up the body is going to turn out to be horror.
Right.
Well, you know, Foucault talked about, you know, the entertainment value of executions, and certainly the Grand Guignol tradition is continuation of that in terms of, you know, the construction of masterful traps and devices of torture.
Mm-hmm.
So another, when you mentioned plotting, I wanted to ask you about a franchise that one of our authors is writing about. I don't know if you've seen it, the Final Destination franchise.
Yes, I have seen. Well, I tell you, I saw the first one.
Okay.
What is there are five of them now?
There are five of them now. And so I guess without having seen the rest of them, I can still kind of ask you the question, which is one of the things that really interests me about Final Destination is that it seems to be this kind of apotheosis of the kind of formulaic plotting that we were describing, the kind of impossible plotting, right, where we don't even have a monster, it's just the force of death itself. And so I kind of thought of it as sort of an apotheosis of the same but different principle in franchise filmmaking. And I was just thinking, like, gosh, how do we apply this to our ideas about curiosity and discovery plots in horror? Are we just waiting again and again for a new batch of schmoes to discover what we already know? Or how might we reimagine curiosity and the discovery plot for long franchise series?
Well, let me just say, I mean, I always think it's useful to start off, you know, one of the first anthologies I ever read as a very young lover in this field was a book that labeled itself as Tales of the Supernatural and Horror. And I think that the supernatural is a large category, and horror is a smaller category, big one, but a smaller category within the larger category of supernatural tales. Certainly, one kind of very popular supernatural tale is the fatalistic one. The one where the person has some kind of precognitive dream of, you know, a number like 21, and then gets on a bus whose number is 21, and then crashes,
mm-hmm.
or they an awful lot of twilight zones of this sort, where and of course maybe the greatest of all of them is the old classical story that Aristotle tells about Miletus. You remember he tells the story about how Miletus is killed and his murderer flees the city and is never captured. But I think he's Miletus of Thebes. But the murderer comes back. And the city has erected a statue of Miletus, and the murderer is looking at it, and the statue falls on him and kills him.
Mm-hmm.
There is no monster. I mean, it's a story of the supernatural. The interesting question of why are stories like that grouped together with horror stories, and I think the reason for that is that we tend to think that in those stories there's some kind of supernatural agency, like Juggernaut was for the Greeks, or Nemesis, actually, rather than Juggernaut. Nemesis was this kind of universal force of justice and the Twilight Zone is often like that too. It's entity-like without being an entity, so it seems like it's close to having a monster. Only the monster is the universe.
Yeah.
And I think that if I can bring it back to the final destination, is an example where there seems to be a force, maybe not in this case of a force of justice, but you know, a force of rectification. I mean, these people were, it says that these people were saved, but they shouldn't have been.
Right, right.
And now the kind of force of rectification in the universe is eliminating them one at a time.
Right.
And, you know, you say, well, is there suspense? Well, there is suspense because there's usually a figure, at least there was in the first one, and I'm assuming the others. There is a figure who the question arises, will this person be able to evade this force or not?
Right.
So you still have suspense. Now you could say, well, can you still have suspense in a franchise? Well, just look, as a matter of just empirical fact, we know that people can, because they keep going back to see repetitions of the same story.
Yeah.
And you know, this isn't a question that just arises with supernatural tales. I mean, people keep going back to seeing romantic comedies with the structure of, you know, boy loves girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl.
Right, right.
I mean, people don't stop going to that because they know that the next one, 9 times out of 10, are going to end that way. I mean, they very rarely don't end that way. The examples of the ones where the boy doesn't get the girl are things like Charlie Chaplin. I mean, that was always what was distinctive about him, that he always opened up to possibility.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't get the girl that he longed for.
Yeah.
But you know, well, most of the rest of the time, you know, Jason Segel is going to get Cameron Diaz.
Right. That's true, and we know that going in. Right. I agree with you.
And we know that, you know, the character who might appear to beguile the maiden will be revealed for the worthless Lothario he is before the last reel.
Right. It's not if he'll get the girl or if he's a Lothario, but how. And the how.
Right.
Continues across franchising, which I think kind of takes me back to the Grand Guignol and that kind of generic confusion that you were suggesting earlier. So Final Destination is both a film of the supernatural and a Grand Guignol movie, I mean, people are splatted in any number of exotic and exciting new ways. But then the suggestion
that's
would be
right.
that
I mean,
it doesn't, it's not art horror, it's not a horror film because it doesn't repulse with an entity.
Yeah, I mean, a good kind of example of maybe a kind of predecessor to that was the horrible Dr. Fives.
Yeah.
Where you know he's going to kill those 10 critics, but he's going to kill each one of them in a more and more imaginative way, and on top of that, complexity and ingeniousness is going to escalate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So another question that I had, which isn't quite about franchisation, but it's more about like transmedia storytelling. I don't know if you go in much for horror television. I was thinking, though, of The Walking Dead, which is now a television series, a graphic novel series, and a video game series. And I was thinking, like, well, what one can do with the monster, how one is allowed to repulse, changes based on the different rating systems or industrial pressures on, as well as, of course, like the formal opportunities of each of these different media. And do we need to adjudicate art horror or adjudicate, you know, our understanding of the zombie and how it can be presented to us based on these both like industrial and medium specific limits that The Walking Dead variously encounters?
Well, I mean, I think that the short answer is sure. I mean, that they're always going to be kind of distribution constraints. I mean, that may not be. I don't know that creates any major aesthetic problem. After all, many of those distribution constraints are probably self-imposed.
Right.
I don't think that you know, M.R. James really was chafing at the bit. He really wanted to put a lot more sex into his stories. I think the fact that he made the wonderful horror and ghost stories he made within those constraints were a function of his personality. Now, when you get into industrial projects like the Walking Dead, that may be a slightly different issue there. People may be saying, "Oh, we can't put that on television. We can't do that if we want this size audience."
Mm-hmm.
That's probably true, but I think TV is becoming diversified enough, and God knows with the internet, the outlets are becoming diverse enough that if you have a compelling desire to go beyond the bounds of mass market television, you can pretty much make any niche that you want.
Hmm.
Presuming you stay not even presuming you stay within the bounds of the law, but probably you ought to stay in the bounds of the law unless you were to get arrested for child horror porn.
Right. Well, one thing one of our writers is discussing is the use of sound in horror television versus horror film, that there's far less regulation about sound, and so you can convey this sort of like the liquidity, the squelching that you describe and cite so wonderfully in The Philosophy of Horror. You can convey that orally
in ways that you're not allowed to show visually. And I found that, I had that in the back of my mind as I was rereading Philosophy of Horror and thinking, like, that's actually, yeah, that's something I want to ask Noel about, how sound design is part of our feeling of fascination, maybe, or repulsion.
Well, of course, I mean, one thing that you probably you know already, and I'm not the first person to say, is that horror, like the detective film, is really a sound film genre.
Yeah.
And it really required sound to take off.
Yeah.
Both of them require sound to take off because both of them involve typically a terrific amount of speculation about what's really going on.
Right.
And advancing and defeating various theories. You can't, it takes an endless intertitle to have Sherlock Holmes explain, you know, how, what really happened at the end. So, and also there's so much going on, you know, Van Helsing talking about the vampire or Dr. Frankenstein talking about how he's going to propose his creation. So they're two genres that really take off in the sound period. They're not quite so major in the silent period. That's not to say there aren't some mysteries and there aren't some horror films, but really, you know, there's nothing like the universal horror cycles in the silent period.
Yeah.
And then of course horror, even more than the detective film, requires that use of off-screen sound, where, you know, you really hear the chains clanking in the night, or the doors slamming, or the heavy footsteps not seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of thing that Val Lewton exploits in the Cat People.
Yeah.
So sound is absolutely required. You know, and it sort of plays into this old time notion, which I am a little skeptical of, which is that people will be much more frightened by what they don't see because their imagination will be much more horrible than any horror fictioneer could imagine. Now, I don't think that's really true. I mean, I think that Clive Barker,
mm-hmm.
Is able to imagine stuff that I could never come up with. It is really much more horrifying.
Right.
Nevertheless, there is a, you know, it's the difference between what sometimes is called suspense and surprise. Hitchcock always emphasized that a great deal, so that the off-screen sound will cause a certain kind of ominous apprehension that's kind of like suspense, whereas the sudden visual revelation of the monster. I remember when I first saw The Hammer Frankenstein as a grammar school kid. I remember I was walking up to the refreshment counter when the bandage was ripped off of Peter Cushing's face.
Uh-huh.
I remember being so shocked that I really was wobbling.
Uh-huh.
To see suddenly a 30 foot high screen, the face occupied in the close up, and that bandage wrapped off, and it'd be, you know, blue and scabby and well. So, I mean, sound, though, of course, is very effective in building to moments like that by building our, let's call it, ominous apprehension.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe, to a certain extent, it may be, this may still be a place where, to a certain extent, cinema projections has a somewhat edge over at least most people's TV resources, because the capacity now of doing kind of three-dimensional sound in a theater that can make a sound behind you, that can make a sound off and, you know, off to the side. It can be a localized sound, whereas from the television, most of us are still getting it, you know, from, we're still getting a sound, even if we have a stereo set, we're getting it from one location.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they can also physically affect you with the sound. I don't know if you've seen the new horror movie It Follows yet, but it has this incredible...
Yes.
So you remember that, like, screeching white noise that just kind of, like, makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, which I thought was so effective in unnerving me and kind of... making me look for an object that...
As I don't have to tell you, the word horror from the French does mean hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Yes, exactly. I think since I learned that, I've paid much more attention to the back of my neck than I ever did before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I actually just had occasion to rewatch It Follows last night, and it was just a delight to see how it follows the philosophy of horror down the line to the point where the last piece of advice that Hugh ever gives Jay before kind of abandoning her on her front lawn is, whatever you do, don't touch it. So there's another filmmaker.
One of the things that you asked about earlier, and this might be useful to mention about changes in horror, is that I think It Follows is one example of it, and that is that, not that it was unprecedented, but especially since the Japanese horror films, the recent Japanese horror films, it became, when I say recent, I'm old enough that probably means two decades. Is that unlike the typical American horror film, you end with closure, both in terms of things being explained, and also usually in terms of there being some kind of finality, even if you realize that it's only finality for this particular episode, and the franchise is going to somehow erect the creature in the future, which of course isn't new, because think of how many times Frankenstein got revived, the Frankenstein monster got revived. But one thing that's happened with, for example, those Japanese horror films, and then the Blair Witch Project, and at least the couple of first paranormals, and now It Follows, is that you don't get an explanation, and you don't get event closure. You don't get the demon sent back to hell, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that kind of inconclusiveness, both in terms that you could call it both epistemic and eventful inconclusiveness, I think one effect of it is, I think, to cause a greater and more kind of generalized anxiety, that the evil can't be explained, and the evil maybe can't be extirpated. It's a kind of, in one sense, metaphysically darker kind of horror than, say, universal horror films where Dracula was always neatly destroyed by the end of the film, not to mention completely explained by Van Helsing.
Right, and that explains, I think, the setting of the film in Detroit, right? When you say that there's a greater and more generalized anxiety, which kind of took me to the, well, it starts a transition to a question I wanted to ask about the end of your book. And when you said that there were kind of, we could find a sort of historical explanation for greater cultural interest in horror around the evident collapse of Pax Americana. And I think you really see that in It Follows, and it kind of explains some sort of cultural preoccupations, you know, the kind of greater participation in a horror culture. But then I wanted to ask you if we could think about the critical interest in the horror genre as also perhaps being related to the collapse of Pax Americana. It seemed really interesting to me that horror criticism also skyrockets in the 1990s and really around this moment of postmodern criticism that you were calling out in the end of your book.
Well, it's certainly complicated. Look, as more horror products are disseminated, it just follows that there's going to be more horror criticism at even just the journalistic level of criticism. But then, you know, to take an old phrase, when the tide is high, all boats rise. So if there's more production and more social discourse about it, well, then there's going to be more actually. Let's call it haute journalism, or even academic writing about it. On the other hand, I mean, it is worth pointing out that if we just don't think of the horror genre, but think of all of the genres with monsters in them that have proliferated. I mean, we have monsters everywhere. There are all these fantasy films.
Mm-hmm.
Outer space films. I mean, it's hard to look and almost, you know, there are so many genres, sword and sorcery, for example, that have monsters as elements in them now. That, you know, it's not just a matter of the horror genre. I mean, the idea of the hybrid and the unholy and the inhuman combinatory figures is just rife across the culture.
Yeah.
And I mean, as that occurs, it's not only in some sense natural, but it's almost incumbent on people who think and write about the discourse of the culture for them to pay attention to it.
And so you think we just are seeing sort of a cultural, I mean, sorry, not a cultural, an industrial lags? I mean, we had so much horror production in the 80s, and then it really tapered off until Scream revitalized the genre in the mid to late 90s. But the early to mid 90s, following Philosophy of Horror and Men, Women, and Chainsaws, is, it seems, and you know, like Planks of Reason and Dread of Difference, there are a couple key anthologies, but the sort of piecemeal theory of horror seems to grow in the wake of that genre. And I just can't help but thinking, like, okay, well, what else did we see a lot of in the 80s? Well, we saw a lot of workout videos, and we saw a lot of children's films, children's videos, but we didn't get preoccupied with writing about those the way we got preoccupied as a field with writing about horror.
Yeah, well, that's pretty interesting. Well, you know, academics are very sedentary, so they weren't going to be participant observers in workout culture.
It would have been interesting.
Actually, I remember I was teaching at Buffalo, and in the truck stop across the street where I would have lunch, the people who were watching the workout culture were these kind of truck drivers who were sitting at the counter, and they were, you know, watching these women in leotards.
Yeah, well.
there was a kind of hidden, unacknowledged audience for workout.
I can see that.
As for the children's thing, I do think there is an emerging children's literature. I mean, Alice and Laurie were certainly interested in it very early, and I think it is kind of increasing. And I think that might have something to do with an interest that's being cultivated, especially by academic women who are also mothers.
Mm-hmm.
They spend a lot of their time with children's literature, and get an interest in it for that reason.
Yeah.
You know, certainly there is a massive you're right, there is a massive explosion in children's literature.
Yeah.
And, you know, and places like Borders pioneered the idea of putting the children's literature in the back of the store so the parents had to go through all of these other things before they got to the children's books. And being college educated, upper middle class parents, they probably picked up a couple of books for themselves on either on the way coming or going. It worked the way putting candy next to the cash register works in the grocery store for children, only kind of in the reverse way.
That's really interesting. I mean, I remember that phenomenon, but I hadn't made the connection before.
No, that was the way they did it.
That's really clever, huh? So I guess one other thing maybe I can close with, because I don't want to take too much of your time, but it always seems interesting to me, you know, one writes these books seeking to make an intervention, and then sometimes it can be quite surprising what people run with, and maybe what you thought, like, well, this is, you know, why is nobody as interested in this part, which was, I thought, more important or had more promise. And I was just kind of wondering how you look back on the philosophy of horror and its reception now. Are there elements that you think that surprised you, that they didn't get more feedback, or surprised you in the way that people have used the book?
Well, I have to say, you know, to tell you the truth, I wrote the book out of love.
Yeah.
I told you, I had certain academic concerns in mind, but, you know, I really did have a hell of a good time writing it.
Good.
And I felt, I have to say, I think its reception, especially its word-of-mouth reception, has been terrific. It still continues to sell very well. You know, and as I said before, it wasn't my idea. It was Bill Germano's idea. So I feel very lucky that I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I guess I'm kind of, in a way, surprised that it still has legs. But apparently it does.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever be quite as lucky. I mean, I wrote a book called The Philosophy of Mass Art that I thought would be a very influential book, and it never reached or had the influence I thought it would. So, you know, you can't tell. I mean, I suppose novelists and filmmakers and artists say this all the time. You can't tell. I feel I was terrifically lucky to have written this book at the time I wrote it, and you know, it may be the best thing I ever wrote. I'd like lightning to hit twice, but I'm not sure it will.
Well, I mean, I see your point that, you know, I think it's a fabulous, fabulous book, right? But that it may be the most popular and the best thing, or the thing that is closest to your heart, are not always commensurate, right? It's not always the same book you'd want, in the coffin with you.
I wouldn't have been surprised. I wouldn't, as I said before, I mean, the reason I didn't ever imagine writing such a book was because I imagined the reviewers at academic presses, you know, writing back to the publisher saying there is no philosophy of horror. And frankly, I wouldn't have been surprised if the, I wouldn't have been surprised if that was the response to the book.
Mm-hmm.
If people said, well, you know, this is strange.
And yet now I think the title of the book is part of what, as you say, gives it legs, right? Because it's...
Well, let me tell you one thing about the title that you may or may want to include. The title is not exactly the title I wanted.
Huh.
The title I wanted was Paradoxes of the Heart, The Philosophy of Horror.
Uh-huh.
And at that, and the publisher said, because I don't know if you remember, at that point, the way they used to have the books cataloged on the retrieval system in the bookstore was they had it on like a sheet, a plastic sheet.
Yeah.
And they only could put like 25 letters or some limited number of letters. They couldn't get a title that long on the thing that the people in the bookstore would use to catalog the book into this or that section, or to look it up if someone came in for it.
Uh-huh.
And so the publisher said to me, if you call it Paradoxes of the Heart, it's going to go into the self-help section. So, and I thought Paradoxes of the Heart was such a much, you know, I thought it was a beautiful title, and that's what I really wanted. But they said, no, you can't have that because it's just going to be put in the wrong section of the store.
Would it be okay with you then if I titled this interview Paradoxes of the Heart and
sure.
closed with this portion?
Finally, my wish will come true.
There you go. I love it. Done.
Okay, well, nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Good luck.
Thanks.
Good luck with your project.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.